ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing the global director of Empowering Frontline Health Workers. This is a dynamic public-private partnership of organizations committed to ending preventable maternal and child deaths, and they're doing it by harnessing the power of mobile technologies. She brings together decision makers from governments, donors, private sector, UN agencies, NGOs, and academic institutions to connect ideas and to drive practical action. She and her team and the wider Empowering Network, more than 200 organizations, are supporting health worker training in 14 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, and most recently, Latin America. Leslie Ann Long, thank you so much for joining us today. Let's start with you giving me and the audience the executive summary of your background and then a little bit about what Empower is.
Okay, thanks, Gabriella. My professional background is working in the UK as a barrister in family law. And from there, I went into academia and I provided law courses and edited books on law before becoming the Dean of the Faculty of Health and Social Care at the Open University. And after my term of office there, I moved into the International Development Office at the university. And in that role, I oversaw a number of large-scale development programs in sub-Saharan Africa, primarily focused on health issues. And our first major project was working in Ethiopia. And we worked with the Ministry of Health and about 57 Ethiopian health experts to create the national curriculum for their 38,000 community health workers. So I worked in that role for some time before getting involved with Empowering when it was launched in 2012 in a voluntary way. And I joined a number of the task force groups for Empowering and really saw the potential in a program that was moving beyond print-based distance education into using mobile to be able to reach even more health workers, particularly those in remote areas. So when the opportunity came up to apply for the position of global director, I went for it and got it. And that precipitated my move from the UK over here to the US 3 years ago. And what's been so enjoyable and fascinating is to see this transition from using very traditional teaching methods and particularly classroom-based teaching methods and using mobile to be able to support health workers wherever they are, whenever they need access to content. And in fact, one of the first things I was able to do as director was take the Ethiopian print-based content and, working with partners on the ground, fund the adaptation of that material to mobile optimize it. And the program that we supported in northern Ethiopia is just coming to an end now. And essentially, it was training 200 health workers using the content on mobile phones to really equip them with the skills and the knowledge they needed to use in the field with their communities. And we're now currently talking with the Ministry of Health and partners on the ground in Guinea to further adapt that same content, translate it into French, and use it to support the ministry's strategy to train its 56,000 community health workers. So, stepping back a bit, what really underpins the work that Empowering does is providing frontline health workers with the very basic information they need that is also at the same time vital to provide the care that they need in their communities. And the reason I say that is because we know that of the almost 6 million children who die every year, many of those deaths are entirely preventable if the health worker or the community or the family has very simple information. So information about how to treat diarrhea, information about how to identify pneumonia, and knowing when to refer a mother or a child on for a higher level facility treatment. Same with the number of women who die every year. There are hundreds of thousands of women who die every year through complications in pregnancy and childbirth that die needlessly for the lack of very simple information. So Empowering's role through the multiple partnerships that we have on the ground and with ministries of health is to ensure that women and children do not die needlessly for lack of information.
Wow. Well, very fantastic. One of the things that typically we discuss on the show is disruption and how technology is disrupting economic models and business models. But what's interesting is in your situation, what you've been able to do is this disruption is actually facilitating life-saving, really. And how you're able to take these technologies and forces and blend them in to make something possible that wasn't possible previously. And it also seems like you're also bringing together many different partners and getting them to, I don't know, it's almost like herding cats, the different parties you've got together. In parsing how I'd like to maybe break down and talk about some of this a bit more, let's talk a bit about how do you mobilize the different parties that you need to get on the same page? What are the ways in which you bring people together? I mean, obviously, the saving of lives, you know, avoiding needless death is a pretty compelling argument, I would think. And yet it was a problem for a while. So how have you mobilized fundraising and communication and getting everybody to support the mission in a manner that is streamlined and effective?
So that's a great question. I think mobilization and coordination are absolutely critical to the success of tackling preventable maternal and child deaths. And the reason I say that is because the landscape has been really characterized by fragmented and duplicated efforts, lots of pilots, which in themselves are very successful, but never go to scale. And the reason, or one of the reasons, is this lack of coordination and lack of collaboration. And one of the things Empowering has been able to do is capitalize on the fact that we're such a small organization, but with a huge network. So for the first 3 years, we only had 2 staff. We now have 5. So that's made a big difference. But what we have is a steering committee of 16 partners and then a wider network of over 200 organizations that we connect with regularly. And one of the things that's really critical with that is getting consensus around a common message and a common vision. The vision's not been so difficult because people don't want women and children to die. But understanding how you can tackle the barriers of poverty, lack of access to internet, so it makes it difficult to get information to people, how you can tackle really difficult geographic dispersed communities. There are so many issues, and too many donor organizations only fund one issue, and they don't necessarily take the whole situation into account. Because we have partners in the private sector, with NGOs, with civil society, with ministries, we're able to bring together really diverse stakeholder groups that each of their own could not tackle the issue, but together have an opportunity to really make a difference. And what we've found is that because Empowering is so small, we're seen as very neutral, and we're seen as being able to facilitate and convene and connect people without looking at what's the angle for us, because our angle is how can we help everyone else do this more effectively. And so we've really seen over the last 18 months to 2 years that we are able to bring together the global players like WHO, USAID, Department for International Development in the UK, and other country government organizations, with private sector, with the Gates Foundation, with ministries of health and ICT, and the NGOs to say, what do you need? What are your country priorities? And how can we support you? It's really hard work, partly because everyone's running around and visiting different countries and, you know, doing their own thing. So just to be able to get people in a room is not straightforward. And that in itself also takes money to be able to get people in a room. So we really do focus on the fundraising. And one of the ways that we're able to do that successfully is being able to tell a compelling story and inspiring people to want to be part of something bigger than just their organization. At the same time, what we battle against is organizations that understandably have their own reporting lines to their board of directors or their shareholders or their constituents who want to know, what are you, organization X, doing in this field? And if you collaborate, it's really hard to show what you as an individual organization are doing because it can get lost in the bigger picture. So there's definitely a tension between how can you get global and local organizations to collaborate, but how can they feel that they're making a distinctive offering to change in the field?
Right, right. Well, and one of the things you said earlier, I thought was quite interesting, where you're saying, you know, everybody's very busy, you know, fighting the fight the task at hand, you know, saving these lives, doing these things. So how do you as an organization structure so that you can interact, you know, you've got this ongoing challenge and problem, which is very real and very urgent. And how can you also be constantly ready and open to onboarding new ideas, new methodologies? And how do you build something that's going to be, I don't know, future-proof or not future-proof, that's the sort of wrong way to put it, but future open, I guess, so that you can always take on as developments happen, that you're able to leverage them. You know, for instance, I imagine that AI and the ability down the road for AI to help diagnose and provide guidance in situations could be very useful. Maybe it's not there yet, or maybe the illnesses and things that people are dealing with are more simple at this point. But how do you filter in and bring in new technologies, and how do you create a predictable process that will help bring in unpredictable inputs?
Oh, what a great question. I'm actually going to write that down and use it somewhere. So first of all, I have an amazing team, you know, 4 staff that behave as if they're really about 10 people. And we create as many opportunities as possible internationally, as well as within the Washington, D.C. and New York communities to interact. So over the last 3 years, we've hosted or co-hosted or spoken at more than 100 events in 13 countries. So it's absolutely exhausting. But the benefit of having so many opportunities to interact with technology specialists, health specialists, government officials, academics, researchers, and so on, is that we're open to new ideas. And that enables myself and the team to connect the dots. So when we hear about something new, we almost always know an organization that we can connect with somebody else. So we're very agile at understanding how technology is changing and shifting and the opportunities that that presents, and then being able to connect organizations that should be talking to each other, but hitherto probably didn't even know each other existed. So this kind of goes back to what I was saying, is that we really connect and convene and help organizations shortcut the conversations so that they can get to the people they need to really quickly. So a lot of it is scanning the horizon. It's being open to meetings with people that at first blush you might think, I'm not quite sure why I'm meeting this person. But then 2 years down the line, you remember exactly why you met that person, and they suddenly become critical to something that you want to do. So it's being open to conversations. It's thinking in new ways. It's creating opportunities for interesting dialogue. Personally, I also read a huge amount, and I find of stuff that's not related to my field, and that always gives me new ideas.
That's interesting. We've been speaking with a futurist, and she was saying how you can't vision the future if you are only using your existing inputs, because you're limited. And so by pulling in other entirely different inputs, it can help you then have the aha moment of insight, because you have new inputs and new ways of looking at it. Otherwise, you're just using the same building blocks rearranged for yourself. One of the things I'm curious about is open source technology and how that's changing things beyond just, you know, changing curriculum to mobile, you know, taking your print curriculum and making it mobile. What are other ways in which new technologies are changing what you're doing for people?
I'm really glad that you asked me that, because open source has the potential to change everything. And by that, I mean that if you focus on existing technology that's available for anybody to use, and that's not so complex that it's open, but you need to pay someone a vast amount of money to understand how to use this open technology, but genuinely open technology, then you can stop worrying about the technology. You can focus on the content and making sure that content is relevant to what's needed. And the other thing it allows you to do is put the process in the hand of the government. You know, governments are bombarded by technology developers with the latest, newest, shiniest, fantastic product. And quite often, for very good reasons, they will buy that product, or they will license that product, or they will go with that vendor. What happens when the technology is obsolete? Then they have to go and buy a new technology. Or when the funding for a program comes to an end, there's nobody there to serve the technology and to continue to manage and update it. But if you use open source technologies, then all of those costs go away. You can innovate on top of them. I'm not saying that you just stick with the old stuff, but what it does is it puts the process in the hands of the government, so then they can actually focus their investment on what really makes the difference for their particular health workforce. I'm not sure I've explained that very well, but it just kind of busts open the whole paradigm of development, which is about constant kind of 3, 4, 5 year programs funded by a donor. It comes to an end and the money isn't there to scale it up. Once you use open source technology, whether it's the content or the platform where it's hosted or the delivery system by which the content is put into the hands of the health worker, then you can start to build out on that instead of constantly reinventing stuff from the start. And if you think about content, you know, if you can go onto YouTube and like put in hand washing. It's 237,000 videos on hand washing.
That's
yeah,
crazy.
We really do not need any more. So the other issue with that is about quality, because increasingly health workers are able to access the internet on their phones and they'll find this content and they'll just use it. And it may be really rubbish content. So one of the things that Empowering is doing is with our content platform called Orb, we are curating the content that goes onto that platform. So everything that's shared with us goes into a pending area and then it's looked at against agreed criteria for quality, both in terms of the clinical quality, but in terms of the quality of the video and the audio. And only when it's approved is it then made available on the site. So ministers and training institutions, NGOs, health workers themselves know that if they get content from Orb, then it's quality assured and it's relevant for their setting and they can be confident about using it. And that's really important, not just in a general way, but if there's a health crisis like Ebola, when there is a surfeit of information coming from multiple directions and the health workers didn't know what information to believe, they need a reliable place that they can go to and think, if I go to Orb and I get my content from there, then I know it's come from a content developer that's been quality assured and I can use that with confidence.
Right. When you're working with ministries, are you able to leverage you're able to leverage the content across user countries that people and countries aren't precious in saying, oh, we only want stuff that's made just for us, or you know what, we don't like that video because it, I mean, are they open to, I'm not sure I'm saying this properly, but sometimes countries can really want to own and control things, and then do they want to insert themselves into the approval process of any of these videos? Or are you able to say, look, this is medical, we own it, if you're going to be on board with us, it's sort of all or none. How does that work?
So it's a very good question to ask, because the primary objective for every ministry is to have content that was developed in her or his country that reflects the people of their country. However, content, good video content and good audio content, is expensive to make, to do it really, really well. So not just the filming, but actually getting the story right and really being able to deliver a message that has a pedagogical underpinning. The reality is that the kind of content we have on our platform, even though it's been developed, I would say, in probably 15 or 16 countries, it's better than pretty much anything else that's out there. So as a sort of temporary situation, most ministries will say, this is really good. We need to find the funding to create content that's filmed and developed in my country. But meanwhile, we can adapt this for the use sort of short term. So, for example, in Nigeria, we have been working with a ministry in one of the states there and a local partner, and we created a 12-week training program from existing material that had been filmed, I think, in Nepal and Zambia, maybe. So not filmed in Nigeria, but we were able to adapt that content and create a narrative around it that contextualized the content for the state in Nigeria. Now, longer term, we will go and we will adapt that content by filming the same story and messaging, but with Nigerian health workers and patients. So I think contextualized content is the optimum. But frankly, most of the stuff that many of these health workers are using are based on outdated Western materials that are not relevant for them. So as long as the content is filmed or recorded in a setting that's authentic and that they recognize, then they are usually happy to use it.
Mm-hmm. How much internet access is there in the countries in which you're working?
Oh, it's pretty patchy. It's usually fairly good in cities. But the further you get out from the urban areas, the less reliable it is. So all of the content from ORB can be downloaded when the health worker has a connection, and then it can all be viewed and listened to offline. So once she or he has that, then, you know, they don't need to be connected to use it. And then they can share it using Bluetooth.
Oh.
So you can really, you know, reach health workers very quickly, as long as, if you think about a health worker as an information hub, if she just has that one-time connection, then after that, the content can be shared, as I say, either through Bluetooth or using SD cards.
Right, right. Interesting. And how often do you then want people to update their, I mean, presumably you're constantly updating what you have. How often do these workers, if they're, you know, coming into a hub, getting downloaded, do you have best practices or protocols that they need to update every certain period of time? Or, you know, how do you make sure that everything is the most current? For instance, if you're dealing with an Ebola breakout or some new health challenge, are there parameters that people are operating with?
We would do it through our communication network. So when new content goes onto ORB, particularly if it's a lot of new content around a particular crisis or there's been updated WHO guidelines on something, then we would communicate through our network that new content has gone on ORB, and we would use social media and stuff like that. So just really building awareness, and also getting our local partners to encourage their health workers when they come to the facility to get paid or for training, to have a look on ORB and see if there's content there that they hadn't previously downloaded that they may want to use. But largely, I mean, ORB only launched a year ago, so largely we're still building a sort of an awareness around it. Content's been accessed now by, I think, about 145 countries. But really through our networks, we're building that awareness of the content that's available, and that we're continuing to add content to the library pretty much on a weekly or monthly basis.
Is it only for healthcare workers? Is this something that that if people were, you know, on some sort of social media, that they themselves, maybe the healthcare worker is only in the location periodically, that you can leave a resource so that local people are able to access it? Or is that not something that's part of the process?
Anybody can upload a resource to ORB, but as I mentioned earlier, we have this content review process that we put all content through. And so we've got materials that have been produced by a fantastic organization in India called Digital Green. And all of the content that they produce has been produced by local health workers. And actually, a lot of their content is focused on agricultural extension worker training. So all of that has been produced locally by local people. It still went through our quality assurance process. So it may not have the same kind of very polished, you know, finish that something, say, from Global Health Media Project or Medical Aid Films will have, that's got like high production quality. But nonetheless, the message is very authentic and has real value. And so we've included it.
Well, I was actually thinking more not from a production of content standpoint, but from a user standpoint. Is the gatekeeper between the general population who's being served, is the gatekeeper for the access, the medical professional, or is it something that, I mean, like, you know, world, I can Google, like, oh, I have the symptom and what's going on and what should I do? Is there any of that kind of thing so that you actually empower citizenry to be the first check?
I completely love that idea. We don't actually have capacity to be able to provide that kind of service at the moment. So what we provide are the resources themselves, the pieces of content, which may be a 5 or 10, 15 minute piece of video. It could be a poster, it could be a fact sheet, but anyone can go onto Orb. You don't need to register. You can just go on. We currently have 6 domains around maternal and child health. We've just added Zika, and we'll be uploading Zika content in the next month. Hmm. So anybody can just take content and just look at it on their phone and share it with anybody. We are increasingly being asked to provide content on many other health areas around non-communicable disease, around mental health, around gender-based violence. At the moment, the funding that we have is very much focused on the 6 domain areas that we have on Orb at the moment. But the great thing about it is the platform itself is open source code. So anybody can take the platform and they could use it for any sector they wanted to. They can just, we would still ask them to acknowledge that they took the original code from Empowering, but they can leverage all of the investment that we've had from our partners, and they could use it for teachers or social workers or adolescents. Wow. Yeah. So, and we have some capacity within the team to be able to advise an organization that wanted to clone Orb and use it for a different audience. We would help them in thinking through how they might do that.
Hmm. So interesting. So interesting. Well, we have used up the amount of time you generously gave to us. But before we close up the interview, I just wanted to ask two questions which are related. One is, what excites you, and then what worries you about, you know, the new technology, the ways in which things are moving?
So I'll start with what worries me. I think there's still a way to go to provide access to information to the most vulnerable populations. They are hard to reach, literally. There is very poor internet or no internet connection. And they're not always aware, even if they have connection, about the information that's just at their fingertips, but they don't know that it's there. So I think there is still a long way to go before we really reach the most vulnerable populations. And I think that donor funding tries hard to reach them, but it doesn't always get there. And so I think really focusing on collaboration and really understanding what are the needs of those poorest and most vulnerable populations is what we should be focusing on. What excites me is that the technology is helping us to do that. And what excites me is seeing government leadership and the global community really coalescing around government leadership and building capacity within governments to be able to understand the needs of those populations. And so I see the role of technology in being able to create access to information that will save lives. It will empower health workers with confidence. Having information makes them feel valued, and it provides them with an authority in their community to really make a difference. So I think the things that worry me are linked to technology, but I think technology also has the power to enable and amplify the basic health services that these community health workers are providing.
Great, great. And what's up next for you and the organization?
I think it's really interesting for us because in a way we're becoming much more focused, because what we're doing is we're taking the model that we've developed, which is open content, create it into a course using open courseware, and then deliver it using an open source delivery system called Oppia Mobile. So we're taking exactly the same model that can then be replicated and adapted in every single country. So our focus is now on this model, which we're calling Open Deliver, and that enables us to expand our reach to across the globe at some point, but significantly from the sort of 14 countries we're in at the moment. I could see that expanding dramatically over the next year.
Fantastic. Well, I certainly hope it goes fantastically well. Important work you're doing. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about it and to share your thoughts around how you structure an organization to onboard new ideas, how you deal with cultural challenges, and how you take what many people see as disruptive technology and make it beneficial for the saving of lives, really. So I really appreciate your time. It's been wonderful.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Gabriella. I've really appreciated it.
Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have been indispensable to bringing this to life. As usual, first and foremost is the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thanks, Rob. Our production team over at Microfame Media, thank you. A big thank you to our guest and new friend, Leslie Ann Long, and of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. We'll be speaking with you again next week, right here on Up Next.